for the Lord's Supper, for what Henny shared. I thank you so much that we have you as our God. Father, I pray that every day you will open our eyes a little bit more to be able to see what it is that we have in you and what it is that we have in your Son and all that you are to us, that we will grasp it more and more. I pray this morning as we talk about the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem and back in Nehemiah's days, I pray that it will spark something in us that we would want to build too, Father. That we will build your kingdom, that we will build our own souls towards you in order to display your glory to the world around us. Please lead me as I speak this morning. I pray in your Son's name. Amen. Okay, we were actually going to start a new series today, The Land Between. We have postponed that with a couple of weeks. Why the change of plan? We have a need for people serving in our Sunday services. I've heard it almost every week since I've been back in Cape Town at the beginning of the year. There, every week someone would say to me, please help, please help, please help, please can you help us? We need more people to help with ushering. We need more people to help with this. We need a big, big need is definitely Kids Zone. And I hear it all the time. And so last week I heard it once again. And I thought, okay, well, maybe we should just change gears, park the Land Between. We'll get to the Land Between in a couple of weeks' time. And just talk a little bit about this. Now, who of you have ever had what I call serving fatigue? In other words, you're a little bit tired of serving. Okay? Serving fatigue. Now, the question always is, why serving fatigue? What brings about serving fatigue? In other words, where I feel like I don't have it in me. I know I should, I know I could, but it's just not there. There can be a number of reasons. It can be a season of life, you know, when you have young children in the house, or they're just born and they cry all night. I was speaking to Jock Hines, who has a young little baby this week, and he's certainly going through many levels of many things currently, so keep him in your prayers as well. It could be that. It could be that you feel discouraged in life, in church, unappreciated. Feel like you don't make a difference, so why do it anyway? It could be that the role feels uncomfortable. I remember the first time I served in Kids Zone, I was 19, 20 years old, and someone asked me to serve in Kids Zone, and I thought, are you out of your mind? Me with children? Do you know what you're asking? So many reasons as to why serving fatigue happens. But what I've seen through my life in the church and being a Christian is most probably the number one reason for service fatigue is purpose fatigue. Purpose fatigue is when I forget what it is that we are doing and why it is that we are doing it. Because purpose, like many other things, it leaks. In other words, you can start life well as a Christian, or even in the beginning of the year, we all have New Year's resolutions of how wonderful we're going to be in the year to come. And then you have that dream, you have that purpose, but it leaks because life comes beating on you, doesn't it? Problems come, challenges come, unforeseen circumstances come, opportunities come, and purpose then leaks. So that is purpose fatigue. I forget what it is that we are doing, and I forget why it is that we are doing it. So I thought it would be great for us to talk a bit about what it is that we are doing and why it is that we are doing it. And that the story in the book of Nehemiah, recorded in the book of Nehemiah, I think is a great point of reference to look at some people who certainly also had both service fatigue and purpose fatigue, but was able, through the help of God and Nehemiah, to turn a corner and see if we can learn anything from that. That makes sense? So off we go. Bit of context here, as always, you know where the story of Nehemiah fits in. About 500 to 600 years before the book of Nehemiah was written or happened, Jerusalem was the epicenter of the Jewish world. I know it's sort of hard for us to really grasp what that is and what it means, but Jerusalem was the land, in the land that God has promised to the Jewish people's forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They inherited the land. They conquered the land. It's the land that they lived for. Solomon's temple was built in Jerusalem. And it was in Solomon's temple that God's Shekinah glory rested. So there was a time when God lived literally in a tent called the tabernacle through the desert wanderings and then under the leadership of David. God said, I want to be amongst my people. And what he said to Moses originally is, build me a tent, a tabernacle I could move with them through the desert. I will come and I will settle my presence inside of the tent. So I'm everywhere, but also in the tent. And they literally built the nation around the tent. Then in David's time, David built himself this wonderful palace. And one day as he was standing in the palace, he looked at the tent. And he said, something's wrong here. Look at my beautiful palace and then look at the outdoor warehouse tent. And so he said to God, man, I want to build you something better. I want to build you a temple. God said, your son Solomon can do it. And so Solomon built a temple. So God moved out of the tent for a moment. Well, as they built the temple next to it, he moved out of the tent and into the temple. The purpose of Israel and the Jewish nation and Jerusalem was really one thing: to display the glory, beauty, and splendor of God. That was their purpose. To be holy. You know, we view holy as, oh, he's so holy, you know, blessed be he. The word holy actually means to be set apart, consecrated to God. So these people, the Jewish nation through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the whole lot, they were to be set apart as holy, as separate, as dedicated to God, so that all the other nations could look at Jerusalem as the epicenter of the Jewish people, and the way that they lived should display God. The relationship, what is a relationship with God like? What does people look like that has a relationship with Yahweh? That was the Jewish people's purpose. That's why God started with Abraham. He said to him, I will bless you and you will be a blessing. And all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you. So that was their purpose. And for a time, they fulfilled that purpose. But then they drifted. They had, you could say, purpose fatigue. Service fatigue. They started worshiping other idols. They started getting involved in all kinds of sins and things. And they were not displaying God's beauty or His glory in any way or manner. And so God warned them and said, listen, you guys have to return to your ways, to my ways. Move away from your ways. Return to my ways and again, display my glory. And if you do, I will be gracious. If you don't, I will discipline you. And he warned them again and again and again and again. He says, if you don't repent of your ways, if you don't display my glory, if you don't remember your purpose, what I will do is I will take a pagan king. He told them up front, with years' notice, I'm going to take a pagan king, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and I'm going to get him to come and he's going to infiltrate Jerusalem in waves. And he will destroy the city. He will break down my temple. I will take my glory away from you, and you guys will be taken as captives into another land, Babylon. Did they listen? No, they did not. So Nebuchadnezzar came, destroyed the city, broke down the temple. God's glory was gone, and the people were resettled in Babylon. But in Babylon, God said to them also, if you change your ways and you worship me again, then I will bring you back, even from the furthest horizons. We looked at that last week in Isaiah where he said, bring my sons from afar, my daughters from the ends of the earth, the people whom I've created for my glory. He is saying, bring these people that are now in Babylon, bring them back to Jerusalem, that they can show my glory once again. And so, drips and drabs, the people started 50 years later moving back, first under Zerubbabel, back to Jerusalem. They rebuilt some of the city, they rebuilt the temple, but they did not rebuild the walls because they were opposed, because because of many other reasons we can consider just now. But the walls then remain that way, and the city remained in that way since they arrived back for another 80 years. Why are the walls important? Who of us has ever lived in Joburg? Who would live in Joburg without a wall? Okay, there's no way I'm going to... When we lived in Joburg, our wall was literally 2.7 meters high with electric fencing on top of that. A wall is important in Joburg. A wall was important in these times too. If a city did not have walls, it was open for attack every single day. 80 years it remained that way. That's where we come into the story. Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. So that's the setting. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, in the month of Kislev, that's December, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile and also about Jerusalem. So Nehemiah is still in exile. He's living in Babylon. He knows that the people have moved back first under Zerubbabel 80 years prior to this. Just 13 years prior to this, Ezra moved with a group of people to rebuild the wall, to reestablish God's ways. And he's saying, how's it going? Back in Jerusalem. Verse 3, they said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates have been burned with fire. He says, how's things going back home? So we're in trouble. It's a disgrace. Conditions are appalling. The walls are nothing but rubble. The city gates are in ashes. And the people around us are laughing at us. They're laughing at our so-called God. Laughing at our inability to reposition ourselves to a position of strength. Things were in bad shape. And they were in that shape, by now, again, for 80 years. I have racked my brain over the last couple of weeks thinking about this as to why didn't they do something? The very first night we moved into our house in Johannesburg, someone broke through the wall. Through the wall. Very first night. Okay. How do you think I responded to that? Let's see if it goes better tomorrow night. I mean, obviously, I called the wall guy. Dude, we need to build this thing bigger, stronger, faster. I called the alarm company. I mean, those guys, they are quite trigger happy over there. I called them and I said, listen here, you need to put a man in front of my house tonight. Oh, Sarah, we can't do that. Let the car drive up and down. How did it happen? How did they, for 80 years, not seem to care? Was it fear? Fear of being opposed, because when they tried to rebuild it 13 years earlier, they were opposed by people around them, because people knew if they were to rebuild the wall, they would become strong again. Were they afraid? Did they feel like, but we've paid our dues, we've been in Babylon, we've been slaves, we've been back, we tried, but it didn't get anywhere, so we've worked hard enough, we hope someone else will come. Were they just comfortable? What did Henny say? I'm not trying to translate it in English. Holy and easygoing, am I lazy boy, something like that. Were they just sort of like, hey, you know what, I'm comfortable, apathetic. I don't care. Did they maybe forget their purpose? Did they maybe forget, but listen, the reason we're actually alive is to display God's splendor. Did they have purpose fatigue? We don't know. We can only speculate. Verse 4 says, when Nehemiah, when I heard these things, so let's see his response to the conditions. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. You notice the difference? Apathy, comfort, fear, don't care, versus weep, mourn, fasted, prayed. From that moment in his prayer, he prays for an opportunity. The God will give him an opportunity with the king in Babylon, and with Nebuchadnezzar. And he will allow him to go back to Jerusalem to work on this effort and to solve this problem. The king grants him the opportunity. He moves back and he helps the Jewish people to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem in 52 days. Something that they were not able to do in 80 years prior to that. 52 days. How did he do it? Is the question. Now, there are a number of things that I think that we can learn through this book, and I will encourage you to go and read it, maybe the whole book by yourself at home. And I'll touch on a number of them next week and the week thereafter. This morning, though, I want to talk about the most important thing in Nehemiah's life that set everything else in motion. That I believe without this one ingredient, this rebuilding of the wall would never have happened. And this ingredient is, wait for it. He had a heart for God to make things better. He had a heart for God to make things better. This mission, this project, this reconstructive effort was not about him. It was about his God. It was about the people of his God. It was about the city of his God. And his purpose as a man of God and their purpose as a nation was to put God's glory on display. And it wasn't happening. His God was being laughed at. His God was being shamed, humiliated, dishonored. His God's people were unprotected. They were the laughingstock of everyone around him. And his heart for God could not allow that to happen. His heart for God had to make things better. Here is a very important truth that I've learned over the years. When you get God, God gets you. And when he gets you, he gets everything around you. When you get, grasp, understand God, who he is, when you see him for all that he is in himself and all that he is for us in Jesus, when you are able to see with the eyes of your heart his beauty, his splendor, his majesty, his might, his excellence, his love, his grace, his ability, his gentleness, his greatness, his holiness, his mercy. When you're able to see with the eyes of your heart his sovereignty and his strength, his supplies, his support in our lives, his salvation, his tolerance of us, his thoughts, his righteousness, his resources, his judgment, his justice. When we get his knowledge, his light and his love, when we comprehend that he is God Almighty, the great I am, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the only one in whom we can be fully satisfied, when we see that, and we grasp that, God will get us. What I mean by that is, God will consume us. Everything changes. Lisa and I dated for, we had a long dating history of complication. But eventually there was breakups, this, that. Eventually when I saw the light better, we dated for about a year. And then I was praying one morning in a field, and I was thinking, why on earth have I not asked her to marry me? She was wondering the same thing. Unbeknownst to me, I found this out later. But as I walked there, I thought, oh my goodness, I have this wonderful woman that could be my wife. Why am I dating her? I shouldn't be dating her. I should be married to her. And I realized it, and I could see her more clearly. I saw her splendor. I saw her beauty. I realized what it is that I had in her. And once I got that, believe me, she got me. I walked away from that prayer and I said, I have to get married to this young lady. And I have to do so ASAP, as soon as possible. One of my friends was a jeweler. I said to him, find me a diamond. We have to make a ring. When I asked her a couple of weeks later for the ring to settle and everything to happen to be my wife, we were married 8 weeks later. From the first time that we spoke about marriage, and the first time we spoke about marriage is when I said, would you please marry me? 8 weeks later, we were married. Why the rush? She got me. I was thin, much thinner back then than now. I was thin, but in my thinness, in those 8 weeks, I lost 7 kilograms out of pure excitement. There was no task too hard, no difficulty too much, nothing that I wouldn't sacrifice. We didn't care where we would live, whether we would live in someone's back room, didn't matter what kind of wedding we would have, didn't matter, because we wanted to just be married. Where did it start? I got and I saw, wow, this is a gift. And that not only affected me and changed who I was, it changed everything around me from that moment forward. It works the same with God. We see it in the scriptures. Psalm 42, the psalmist says, as the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, my God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When can I go and meet with Him? The psalmist got God and he said, man, I get who God is, the living God. My soul, like a deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants. I want to be with Him. Understand who it is. Understand what it is that He is offering me. I have to be with Him. Psalm 16:11. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand, pleasures forevermore. In your presence there is fullness of joy. God, when I'm with you, I'm filled with joy. At your right hand, there are pleasures forevermore. This is someone that got it. They got God and God got them. In Exodus 34, God gives Moses the Ten Commandments on the two tablets up on Mount Sinai. And it says in Exodus 34, verse 29, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the covenant law in his hands, he was not aware that his face was radiant because he had spoken with the Lord. He came back. He was in God's presence. He got God. And God got him in such a way that you could see it on his face. And in the beginning, he didn't know it. But what happened is he came down the mountain and the people saw him. It says they ran away from him because his face was glowing. And Moses literally had to call them back and say, guys, it's me. It's me, it's Moses. But he could see God for all that God is. It changed him. It changed his face. I've often seen that. You can see it in people's eyes. You can see that they have been with God, or that they are with God, or they are walking with God. There is something in the eyes. Have you seen it? There's a sparkle. There's just something different. In 2 Corinthians 3, verse 18, Paul refers back to the Moses scenario, and he says, "And we all who with unveiled faces," in other words, we need to lift the veil. Moses eventually put the veil over his face to cover it. He says, "And we all who with unveiled faces contemplate, behold, look at, take in the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his image with an ever-increasing glory which comes from the Lord." He says, if we get God, if we contemplate him, if we behold him and we behold Jesus and we look at him and we see his splendor, his beauty, his majesty, and we keep on doing it, it will affect us. He says that in itself, our times with God in itself will change us from one degree of glory to another. Where does it come from? Having a quiet time? No. Beholding. Contemplating. Seeing who God is with the eyes of your heart. When we fixate ourselves on him, we will be transformed. And what I've realized at times in my own life, and I think for many others, if God hasn't grabbed the attention and the affection of our hearts, it simply means that we don't get who he is. Because if you get him, he gets you. And when he gets you, he gets everything around you. My beautiful masterpiece. Here is Nehemiah. With a heart. Nehemiah was able, I believe, as David, as Moses, as many others, as Paul, were able to see God for all that he was. In the process, in them seeing God, God got them and infiltrated and affected their hearts, his heart. And as it radiates, what does it do? It affects everything around you. Here was a condition of apathy, of not displaying who God is, of not displaying his glory. Nehemiah's heart could not handle that. It couldn't. It was an impossibility. His heart for God had to make things better. Because if you get God, God will get you and will change everything around you. How is that relevant to us, and how is that relevant to our daily lives and to Sunday services? Take a look here with me in Hebrews chapter 12. In Hebrews chapter 12, the author speaks about the church compared today, compared to Jerusalem, compared to Moses meeting with God. And he says in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 18, he says, when we meet for church like today, you have not come to a mountain that can be touched. Right? You're not coming to Sinai. You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further words be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. Even if an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, "I am trembling with fear." He's saying, we're not back at Mount Sinai when God went up and got the, Moses went up to meet God and got the tablets, where people couldn't even bear to hear God's voice because it was so terrifying. And even Moses himself said, "I'm trembling with fear." He says, you've not come to that. As glorious as that is, and as awe-inspiring as that was, you have come to something else. Verse 22. But you have come to Mount Zion, the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, the Spirit of righteous made perfect. He's saying, guys, as amazing as Moses' meeting was with God, that's not what you've come to. He says, every time we meet, we are supposed to have a little bit of a taste of the heavenly Jerusalem. Every time we gather, every time we worship, every time our kids meet, that is what is supposed to happen. We are coming to the firstborn, the church of Christ. That's what church should be. Take a look with me in Revelation chapter 5. So we are, you could say, in many ways, although this is not our title, we are even here living in the land between. This land between, a different land between that we'll look at in a couple of weeks. This land between is we're not in Jerusalem on earth 2,000 years ago, or 3,000 to be exact. Neither are we in the Jerusalem in heaven, the new Jerusalem. We're in the middle. What does the new Jerusalem in heaven look like? Revelation chapter 5. This is the Apostle John sees a picture of heaven and what happens in heaven where there's a need for Jesus to step in and save the day. And it says there in verse 1, then I saw on the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. He's seeing God. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll? But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. Then one of the elders said to me, do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals. Then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. The lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out throughout all the earth. He went and he took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the lamb. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of God's people. And they sang a new song, saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain. And with your blood you purchased for God men and women from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth. Then I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. And a loud voice they were saying, worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise. Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them saying to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb, be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever. The four living creatures said, amen. And the elders fell down and they worshipped. That's what heaven is going to be like, friends. We will just be in total awe and wonder with all the angels and all creation before God saying, worthy, 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 worthy is the Lamb. We come from Jerusalem. Where we are supposed to go to is the heavenly Jerusalem. We are currently rebuilding the wall and the land between. And Sundays is supposed to be a taste of that. Every Sunday. That's what we get to, through God's grace, experience. As we were singing the songs earlier on, and I'm very grateful for our worship team, I thought, you know what, in all honesty, those few moments where we sing are most probably the only tranquil moments in my week. Because even as I read my Bible in the morning, I'm with bated breath waiting for one of my children to wake up and ask me something. It is in those moments that I can really take my eyes and my ears and everything off of everything and really try and get God. All that He is for us in Jesus. We have that opportunity every Sunday. What role do we play? Well, each and every one of us have an opportunity every Sunday, every day really, to either add towards that experience or to take away from it. If I am prayerful during the week for the Sunday service, and this morning as we were singing, I was thinking, I'm not praying for the worship team enough. I pray for them, but I'm not enough. If I'm praying for them, and I'm praying for our fellowship, and I'm praying for our kids' zone, and I'm praying for my own soul on a Sunday morning as I come to church, I am adding towards the experience. If I neglect to pray, if I'm not in God's presence, if I stumble out of bed to church, I'm taking away from the experience. A couple of years ago, I read about a church who had a prayer ministry for the pastor during the service. And that during the service, what they would do, there would be a group of brothers and sisters meeting, just praying for the pastor's message while he was preaching. That it will do its work. That it will affect hearts, adding or taking away. They are adding. When I am early for church, am I adding or am I taking away? I'm adding. When I'm late for church and I stroll in here at my earliest convenience, which is very convenient for me and not early at all, am I adding to the experience or am I taking away? If I am fully engaged in worship and in song, am I adding to the experience? Totally. God is being displayed. My voice is heard amongst the angels. If I talk to someone else while we're worshiping, I'm taking away. If I'm distracted and thinking about all kinds of things, I'm taking away. Everything is an opportunity. If I'm in kids' zone, and I pray for those kids, and I pray in the morning for every kid that I know will be in my class, maybe a couple of surprises, but in general I know will be there. If I'm praying through them throughout the week, and I'm praying for them in that morning, and I'm praying, God, please somehow help me in my preparation and what it is that I do and how I interact with them and how I interact with their parents. Am I not adding to the experience, adding to the opportunity of displaying God's glory? Everything matters. I appreciate any sharing someone who's not feeling well, waiting here to make sure that they get met, that they get welcomed, that they find a spot, and that they're good to go before they go back home. It matters. If you're an usher, it matters. If you're on the sound desk, it matters. If you are counting money for the contribution, you're keeping us above reproach, it matters. Every single thing matters. But what matters more is your heart for it. A heart for God to make things better. See, when we develop and continue to develop that heart, we look around and we say, wow, how can I make this better? How can I interact with the kids in a better way? How can I be a better usher? How can I be a better worship leader? Not that I'm filled with guilt and, oh God, I don't measure up. I'm not talking about that. Just my heart for God just wants to make it better. I'm in this spot. I have seen God for all that He is. And I have my up days and down days. You know, we don't always live on Sinai. Neither did Moses. As a matter of fact, in that passage, Paul says that he thinks that Moses sometimes put over the veil so that people couldn't see that his face was fading. He was having bad quiet times. Okay? So it's not always that it's always reflecting and I'm always there, but you guys get the gist of it. If this is my heart, then I want everything to be better. I want it to be better. And I believe you do too. But I think when we don't get God, we get purpose fatigue. And when we forget why we are here to display His glory, we get service fatigue. And what I want to ask us is, let us take our eyes again off of ourselves. And let's put our eyes back on God. Because when you get God, God gets you. And when He gets you, He gets everything around you. God bless. Let's close with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we I often think that I don't think we have it in us to fully get you. Because if we did, we would be too overwhelmed. And yet we pray, Father, that every day that you will continue to help us to see and grasp a little bit more of who you are, and that we will not be overwhelmed in a sense of guilt, but if we're overwhelmed with anything, we would be overwhelmed with wonder, overwhelmed with appreciation, overwhelmed with gratitude, that we will realize that in you and you alone can we find our peace. And in you and you alone can we find our satisfaction. Father, I pray that in the next couple of months, as we are in desperate need,